Well, welcome to another issue of Christian Doctor's Digest. You may have wondered if you got the right thing to listen to because we have new theme music, and I hope you like it as much as we do. Well, we've got some great topics on this issue that I think you're really going to enjoy. I was down in Texas not long ago, and I had the opportunity to have breakfast with about a dozen doctors. And before that, one of my board members who was there locally said, "Dave, you know what they want to talk about at breakfast?" I said, "No." He said, "Burnout." He said, "This is just becoming a huge issue, not only for these docs, but the residents that they're helping to train." This is a big topic, and CMDA is really trying to deal with it and help our members. We're going to have Stan Haggard on talking about burnout prevention with some practical suggestions that'll be helpful to you and those you know. And then we have a very special guest. Johnny Erickson Todd is joining us. Johnny's been on our board of reference almost since I started. She's a great friend, and she's going to update us on some of the things going on in our intensifying relationship with Johnny and friends here at CMDA. And then we're going to get into the issue of physician-assisted suicide that she and I am very concerned about as this is attempted to be legalized across the country. Well, let's don't take any more time away from these hot topics. Let's get to the first one. Introduce two people as we go into this next interview. The first one is Dr. Mike Chupp. Mike is my executive vice president of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. I've known Mike clear back to the time he was a student and came to Tenwick in the late 80s. In fact, I encouraged him to come back and consider God's call in his life as a missionary. And God did that, and he spent over 20 years there as a surgeon and also their medical superintendent. I've asked Mike to actually do this interview with Stan Haggard. Stan is a physician, former missionary himself in Gambia, West Africa, was very isolated, experienced burnout, and went through recovery and returned to the mission field. And from that, got a real passion to help others to learn to care for themselves while serving others. And has been very involved in that ministry now that he's back and based in the States. Mike's going to be interviewing him on this important topic of burnout prevention.
Dr. Stan Haggard, thanks for joining us today on Christian Doctor's Digest. Happy to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think the impetus for this interview today, I had the opportunity to hear you share with a large group of surgeons with the Pan-African Academy of Christian Surgeons last November, and you gave a talk to all of us entitled, "Open a Space and Pour in Grace, How You Can Be a Source of Renewal for Missionary Physicians." Can you tell us just a little bit about how you became involved in missionary member care?
Well, I was a missionary in West Africa for about a 13-year period, 10 years actually on the field. And about the end of my second term, something was definitely wrong. I began to be cynical. I was exhausted. I no longer had joy. I began to distance myself from others there, both nationals and missionaries. I lost interest in doing things I used to enjoy. And, you know, at first I just attributed this to regular missionary stress. But over time, I just began withdrawing more and more and really found myself in a very dark place. And this was back in the early 2000s, actually, and people weren't talking much about burnout then, and so I had no label to put on this, but I began to learn that I was really suffering from burnout, and it wasn't a very unusual experience. So it happens to lots of people. So in the course of recovering from that, I learned a lot and became very passionate about wanting to help others avoid stepping in some of the holes I had stepped into. So that began my journey toward understanding this and being interested in member care.
Since then, it seems like the literature, medical literature, is just a wide proliferation of articles. It seems like I pick up a journal every week and there's something about burnout here in the U.S.,
That's for sure. The numbers are really quite frightening. I think I've read that more than 50% of U.S. physicians are reporting at least some symptoms of burnout, which is really amazing. It's really taking its toll.
Today, I'd like for our listeners to hear from you a little bit about you were a missionary doctor and you had your own personal experience with burnout. You've also, I know, practiced up in the state of Michigan. You and I have a lot in common. I was also in Africa for a number of years and had the opportunity, the blessing of taking care of patients also in the state of Michigan. And I know that burnout is not just a cross-cultural problem. It's also a big problem, as we've alluded to, here in the United States. So would you talk a little bit about this whole entity of burnout? What is it? And then what it looks like? How does it differ in the United States in healthcare versus some of our missionary colleagues overseas?
Well, first of all, burnout is something that happens to people that deal with people. Doesn't often happen to people that work with inanimate objects, but those who are face-to-face with people, perhaps in crisis or difficulty, day-to-day, day in, day out, they tend to burn out. So it affects pastors, it affects healthcare workers, policemen, firemen. You know, anyone that's involved with people can experience this. And people smarter than I have put this together really in three components that comprise the burnout syndrome, and they spell the word RED, but I'll present them as ERD. ERD is not anywhere near as memorable as RED, but anyway, it makes more logical sense to me.
Sure, sure.
The E stands for exhaustion, and exhaustion is primarily emotional with burnout, but as you know, we're whole beings, and so emotions, our physical bodies, our spirits, our minds, all can be just drained to the dregs, basically, by giving out and giving out without attention to replacement. So the E stands for an exhaustion that's pervasive, and a simple vacation or a little time off just does not restore you. So that's the E for the burnout syndrome. And then the R stands for a reduced sense of personal accomplishment or personal adequacy. You know, you're going along, and from everyone else's perspective, you're having the same kind of work output, but inside, internally, you feel like you're just spinning your wheels. And if anyone really knew what was going on inside, you think they would expose me as an imposter. In fact, this can get to the point of something called the imposter syndrome, which for me in West Africa kind of looked like this. You know, I had degrees behind my name. I had prefixes in front of my name. I seemingly had all the qualifications I needed for that job. I thought I was ready to go. But as I was burning out, I started to say things to myself like this. You know what? They must have really been hard up when they let me into medical school. And on the day when I applied to the mission board, you know, they felt sorry for me probably, and they just let me through because they were hard up for missionaries. And, you know, anyone, any day now, someone's going to show up here and expose me as an imposter. You know, I'm really not cut out for this job. And really what that is the sign of a depleted soul. You begin really to have a lot of self-doubt. And the D stands for depersonalization. You know, sometimes early in the burnout process, we set up healthy distance, healthy boundaries to try to protect ourselves and our resources and maybe draw in a little bit from contact with others. But as burnout progresses, that distancing turns into a sense of blaming others for your own discomfort and really holding people at arm's length. I began to view people as the enemy, really. And if I could only get away from them, I would be all right. You know, I'd be a wonderful missionary if it wasn't for all these nationals. Mm-hmm. That's how I began to think. And so that's really irrational, but as you become more and more depleted, you kind of withdraw in boundaries that are no longer healthy, and you even keep away people that could be restoring for you.
I've heard people talk about the dark side of altruism, the dark side of who we are as healthcare professionals, and that I think you have a term that you use for that, something about mutation that you used in November. Tell us about these mutations, this dark side of who we are as healthcare professionals.
Well, we all come into our vocations with sets of values that we really have grown up with. For the Christian physician, that's especially true because we come in, I think, to the profession with the idea of not only treating physical need, but building the kingdom. You know, we want to see people come to Christ and realize their need for Him. We want to exemplify Christ's love and compassion for others. We value service. You know, we want to uplift the needs of the poor and the marginalized and the suffering. And so we come in with these values really inherent in who we are. And as we come into the medical world, we also undergo a socialization process. into a medical culture. Sometimes we don't realize that this is happening, but that culture also has values. Altruism, which you already mentioned, is we're expected to put patients' interests first and to be self-sacrificing. We have a strong sense of duty, a commitment to service to others. Long hours, you know, they sort of go with the territory, and we feel that we should really devote ourselves to them. Excellence is also very important. We want to exceed the expectations that are on us, and we want to have a commitment to lifelong learning, for example, and a sense of honor and integrity. But what can happen as we find ourselves in a setting of unlimited need and great pressures, whether it's overseas or whether here in the U.S., these values can undergo mutations. You know, they become a part of our DNA, but that DNA can mutate. And this idea of excellence can mutate into perfection. In other words, we begin to feel that we can never make a mistake. And so we can put on a false cloak of competence, believing that mistakes are unacceptable. And if a mistake is made and if someone is harmed, then surely someone is to blame. I remember lecturers back in medical school saying things like, if you don't pay attention to what I'm telling you right now and learn this, someday, somewhere, you're going to kill somebody.
Hmm.
I don't know if you ever experienced
yes.
that or not, but I remember that. And so, you know, we are expected to be perfect, and really perfection is an unattainable value. But some of us respond to that tension by feigning omniscience. We pretend that we know everything. And I think we've all known healthcare professionals who masked their own fear and uncertainty with swagger and bluster. So that's one example of a good value that can go wrong and set us up for trouble.
And I think there's a degree of somehow feeling invincible. Is there not? I came across a quote the other day by Alessandra Pinckney, who I guess is a licensed psychologist. She was with Doctors Without Borders. And this quote, "We make exhaustion, burnout, busyness, and grit into status symbols. We measure how cool we are by how much we can endure." What do you think about that quote?
Oh, that's a great quote. And that comes right into the next thing that we tend to fake, and that is omnipotence. You know, we begin to believe that, you know, our sense of duty can sort of morph into complete denial of physical, mental, or emotional limitations. You know, the old joke on my surgery rotation was, what's the problem with being on call every other night?
Right. You miss out on half the cases.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, subtly, as we are trained, these values are built into us that we don't have limits. And we begin to fake qualities that really only God truly possesses, like omnipotence. But then also, with that invincibility, there's a sense in which we are to be emotionally invincible as well. You know, we're not really trained, at least we weren't back when I was in residency in medical school, to really learn how to grieve well. When someone dies, you know, we pretty much have to keep the game face on and go on to see the next patient. And so we can learn to wear this cloak of silence because others around us are not trained on healthy expressions of emotion. And so we believe that no one else is feeling what we are inside. And so that can be also a great source of strain.
Stan, in November, you shared with all of us surgeons a very important concept about grace and a tool. You call it the cycle of grace. Can you tell our listeners about this cycle of grace?
This was actually developed by a physician, a man named Frank Lake, back in 1966, a psychiatrist, actually, who's British. And he was noticing missionaries going to India and coming back after a short time, you know, cynical, exhausted, burned out. So he got together with a theologian, Emil Brunner, and together they tried to figure out why this was happening and also why this doesn't seem to be reflected in the life of Jesus. And so they came up with this fascinating thing that they termed the dynamic cycle and has recently been revived in popularity by Trevor Hudson and Jerry P. Haas in their book called The Cycle of Grace, Living in Sacred Balance. So that's where this is from. But if you'll imagine a clock face with me for a minute, and up at the 12 o'clock position, put the word acceptance or identity. Think about the baptism of Jesus in the first chapter of Mark. Do you remember when he came up out of the baptismal waters? A voice came from heaven and said this, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." And you know, when you think about it, what words do we more long to hear from our Father than, mm-hmm. "I love you and I am pleased with you"?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it impresses me that this was said by God the Father to God the Son before he had even done one thing in regard to ministry. He had not met any needs. He had not healed any diseases. He had not said any words. He had not preached the gospel yet. And yet his Father said, I love you and I am pleased with you. And I think that that is so important for us to enter ministry, no matter what it is, knowing that our acceptance is based on our identity in Jesus Christ. It's not based on anything that we do. God loves us and he won't stop based on anything that we do or don't do.
So what's at 3 o'clock?
Okay, 3 o'clock then is something called sustenance. And if you notice in the life of Jesus that he had all kinds of activities then that stemmed from his identity by which he sustained himself. He had solitude and prayer. He regularly dismissed needs around him. He dismissed crowds, said no to needs so that he could be alone with his Father and re-energize and reconnect. And not only that, he had a rich relational life. He had disciples, of course, that he worked with closely, but then he had friends. He had people like Mary, Martha, and Lazarus that he just loved to get together with. And Jesus was often accused of being at parties a lot, you know, a lot of social gatherings, a lot of time being with people. And then, of course, there was Sabbath, which as a Jew, he would have practiced and taken time away from a busy schedule to do no work, but to pay attention to restoration. He also slept, even in boats that were being tossed on the waves. He ate when he was hungry. We just really notice a rhythm of work and rest in his life that stems from the fact that his worth and identity were not based on what he was accomplishing. They were flowing from who he was, loved son of his Father. So then down to the 6 o'clock position, put the word significance. And that word comes from the word sign. And Jesus' life was a sign. And he said many things about himself and who he was. He said, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and I am the door, the bread of life, the good shepherd. And he said that his purpose was to seek and to save that which was lost. So out of that time with his Father, out of that identity of who he was, then flowed this sense that this is my song to sing in the world. You know, God sends each of us into the world with a song to sing, and Jesus knew what his was. So I think that ministry then is not only about what we do, it's mm-hmm. more about who we are. And actually who we are is going to be remembered a whole lot more than what we actually do.
Yes.
So then over at the 9 o'clock position comes this idea of achievement or ministry. Lake's word was achievement. Trevor Howard has actually replaced this with the words fruitfulness in obedient ministry, mm-hmm. which I really like. Mm-hmm. Because rooted firmly in his acceptance by the Father and then nourished and directed by his sustaining activities and assured of his unique significance, Jesus' life flowed then in fruitfulness, in obedient ministry. And, you know, that is just a very, very important thing. I'm really impressed by Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 10. You know, we all can quote 8 and 9, but verse 10 says, for we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God has prepared for us to do ahead of time. That's a rough paraphrase. I don't have my scripture open in front of me.
I think it was pretty good.
Okay, thank you. But for example, if I were to hand you some eggs, Mike, and you put your hands together in a cup, and I started piling eggs in there, you know, we'd probably get maybe 8 or 10 eggs in your hands, and then they'd start hitting the floor, and we'd have omelets before long. Mm-hmm. But if I got LeBron James over and started handing eggs to him, I bet I could get a couple dozen in his hands, but they would still start hitting the floor after a while. Mm-hmm. So that's to say that God made each of us differently with different capacities. But not only did he prepare us exactly the way he wanted us to be, he also prepared the works exactly suited for us. And so, you know, if I am overloading my life and piling on too many ministries and the eggs are hitting the floor, I could berate myself and say, oh, you worthless failure. Or I could ask myself, have I really been putting too many eggs in the hands that were created for fewer eggs? And so I just really love the idea that God created the works for us and us for the works, and that our achievements flow out of our identity in him, our sustenance, and our significance, which he has tailored just for us.
That's very powerful, Stan. I was medical director for a number of years in Kenya, a large mission hospital called Tenwick, and I would notice that a number of all my medical staff, both national and missionary, they all had different capacities, and I had to pay especially close attention to those who seemed to have a lower capacity for different stresses, loads. And you've put it so well that, you know, LeBron James' hand versus mine and a different capacity there. And so it's sort of those of us who are leaders, who are responsible, whether it's in the United States healthcare system, responsible for other physicians, other healthcare professionals, PAs, nurses, it behooves us to know well those who work with and for us so we take good care of them. Would you agree?
Absolutely. That's so very important. And to recognize our differing capacities and also to be monitoring for signs of burnout. If you permit, I would just like to mention that burnout, I think, happens when we try to go the wrong way around this cycle of grace. In fact, as I was teaching about burnout after my recovery, I used to talk about, you know, things that I could do differently to change my lifestyle, to spend more time paying attention to my own needs. And in one of these seminars that I taught, someone asked me, "So Stan, what was happening to you spiritually when you were burning out?" And at first I said, "Well, I think I was fine. You know, I was having my quiet time. I was preaching. I was ministering. I was, you know, keeping up the output." Basically, my answer was I was keeping up my spiritual achievements. But as I reflected more and more about what was happening, what I now realize is that really I was running the wrong way around this cycle of grace, that even though I would have denied it, I was basing my identity on how much I could achieve. In other words, if I could just keep this ministry going, God would notice how dedicated I am to Him. And subtly, I was believing that, you know, maybe He will love me more, or maybe I can sustain His love for me, because I was rooting my significance in my achievements and then trying to draw sustenance from my significance and then using that then to secure my identity. You know, at any point in this cycle of grace, we have a decision to make about which direction we're going to draw from. So if I'm down there at significance, if I'm not drawing it from sustenance and identity, I'm going to start to draw it from achievement. And then if I'm around at sustenance trying to get that from my significance, what happened was I was plopped into a setting of unlimited need, and my ability to keep achieving was on the ropes. You know, I could not keep achieving. And what was most threatening about that was that I began to fear deep down inside that I would no longer be significant, and because of that, I would no longer be loved. And that's a dangerous place to be.
Dr. Stan, it seems like in the last year or so, there has been a little bit of a shift in emphasis in the healthcare literature away from what you as an individual do in terms of helping build your resilience and prevent burnout to looking at the bigger system issues, organizations, and care for their workers. So what have you seen, and what would be your comments about that shift in emphasis?
I'm very happy to see it, because it's important to realize that burnout doesn't happen in a vacuum. And some of the early literature, I think, focused more on our efficiency of practice. In other words, even though that's very important, if we can simply improve our use of electronic medical records or help our office staff to get more training, then we may be able to, you know, reduce the sense of chaos or the sense of loss of control that many physicians feel. And though that's an important area, it's one of only what I'd like to identify as three important components to physician well-being. And others actually have put this together in a paradigm, but I'll describe it to you. Imagine a pie in front of you, and it's cut into three equal pieces. The piece on the right side, shall we say, would be efficiency of practice, and maybe the piece at the base of the pie would be physician resilience. And over on the left side, we could call it corporate culture or organizational culture and values. And the emphasis on physician resilience is certainly important, but we can't neglect the fact that all organizations have a set of values that drive them and drive their decisions. In fact, you're aware that we put canaries down into coal mines, and we do that for a reason. Canaries have a weaker constitution, and they tend to die when the environment just begins to get toxic with gases or something like that. And so they're there for a reason. And when they die, you need to address the toxic environment. But sometimes the literature on physician resilience seems to suggest that really what we just need are tougher canaries. You know, we need to build stronger physicians that can weather more difficult things. When in reality, we also need to look at the toxicity of the environment and see whether there are values that are driving this to view physicians more as tools that simply need to be used until they wear out and need replacing. But I think a healthier approach is to view our people as our most important resource. Without our people, we don't have an operation, and we need to view them as targets of our ministry, if you will, as well as those who are engaged in the ministry. So investing in their well-being is just very important. And sometimes physicians, as they become healthy, as they learn resilient habits, they can have a powerful influence back on the organization to advocate for a more sane environment and a healthier environment.
And I'm delighted to see, Stan, I'm sure you are also, to see popping up all over the country physician wellness centers and certainly mission organizations taking this very seriously over the last few years, member care, and making sure that missionaries are whole and taken care of to prevent this burnout, which leads to a significant loss of folks serving on the field.
Absolutely. And even if people on the field are not burning out completely, there's a whole lot of brownout out there. If you understand it,
yes.
You know, that's and a lot of stages of wellness that really could be improved. I actually put a 4-stage tool on our website that looks at shalom and doing okay and survival and then burnout. So often when we ask, how are you doing? The answer can be, oh, I'm surviving. But really, I think that it's okay to strive for shalom and to bring those things into our lives that'll help us serve with enduring joy instead of slogging through.
Well, let's just wrap up this interview with a little discussion about resources. Your talk in November was, you know, how to bring help to others that we notice are displaying symptomatology of burnout, either early or late. At CMDA, we have Life and Leadership Coaching Ministry led by Dr. Steve Sartori. And one aspect is coaching physicians and dentists through periods of time which are difficult and helping them to figure out ways to deal with the ERD that you described earlier. And folks can go to the CMDA website and look up our coaching ministry and how to get in contact with those good folks. But talk to us about other resources. You've been involved in this member care for a number of years, so you must know some great resources for our constituents to go to.
Sure. And I would just like to mention my wife and I have started an organization called Serving with Joy. And we have a website, servingwithjoy.org, all small case. If you go to .com, you get a different organization. But on that website, we have links to many of the resources that you mentioned and can be helpful. I would just like to highlight one. For the past 2 years, we have held a retreat for cross-cultural healthcare workers, for missionary physicians and nurses and others at Alongside Incorporated, an organization just near Kalamazoo, Michigan. This is a great organization. We spend 9 days unpacking what we've just said in a few minutes here and especially applying it to the mission setting. So I would invite anyone who is interested in being part of that to please, you can get a hold of that link through our website as well, but it's alongsidecares.net. And also on our website, we have links to other organizations that are very helpful, not only for medical missionaries, but also for physicians in the U.S.
Dr. Stan Haggart, it has been a delight to host you today on Christian Doctors Digest. I pray for you the best as you interact with not only our members here in the United States doing healthcare, but also with our missionary members overseas, that God's kingdom can be expanded with healthy workers in the harvest.
That's my goal and my aim, and I want to thank you for inviting me to be with you today.
Let me remind you of Stan and Deb's website, servingwithjoy.org. Now, this is a big issue, and I got toasty when I was a missionary, almost burnt out, and I had to reset my life. I've got a great resource that if you need to reset yours, prophylactically or because you're getting toasty. It's called Reset, Living a Grace-Packed Life in a Burnout Culture. It's by David Murray. It's available at cmda.org in our bookstore, or go to 888-230-2637. Call us at that number, and we can get that to you right away. CMDA is focusing more and more on this issue. Steve Sartori and his team are really doing this through a new endeavor called the Center for Well-Being, because this issue is so pervasive and so common. Today, over 50% of healthcare professionals are dealing with burnout, and so I know many of you are as well. We'll be praying for you, and we stand here to help. Welcome to this edition of TaxWise Moment. I'm so happy to welcome Jamie Campbell, my Vice President of Stewardship, as my guest.
Thank you, Dave.
Jamie, you were telling me now's a good time to start considering whether a charitable gift annuity makes sense for a member. Let's get back to the basics for a moment. Remind me, what's a charitable gift annuity?
Sure. Dave, a charitable gift annuity, or CGA, as we call them, is an agreement between a charitable organization, in this case CMDA, and a donor, where the charity agrees to pay that donor or donors a fixed income for one or two lifetimes in exchange for the donor funding the annuity. It's pretty simple. If you itemize charitable deductions, there's an upfront tax deduction you can take, and then most of the regular payments of annuity income will be largely tax-free from federal income tax during the annuitant's life expectancy. Finally, a gift annuity can pay income immediately, or you can do it on a deferred basis.
So who would be a good candidate for a gift annuity?
I think a good candidate for a gift annuity is someone who obviously has a heart for giving and wants to support ministry, but at the same time, they may have some concern about their retirement income. They don't want to outlive their resources down the road. With a gift annuity, you can give, like we say, while you also receive. You're supporting the ministries you care about. At the same time, you're receiving an income for life.
So you said something that caught my attention. You say it can be either immediate payments or a deferred basis. How's that work?
That's right. A current or immediate gift annuity would pay a fixed income for life in quarterly payments beginning now for the annuitant's lifetime. And then if there's a spouse, husband or wife, who's an joint annuitant, the surviving spouse would also receive that payment for their lifetime. A deferred gift annuity makes payments at a specified date in the future, and as such, the fixed rate of interest will be higher once those payments begin because the annuitant obviously will be older and their life expectancy will be shorter. Many times, deferred annuitants use this option to generate an additional income in their retirement years.
Okay, let me use me as an example. I decide I want to know more about gift annuities. How does that work?
Dave, we partner with the National Christian Foundation in this program. NCF issues the gift annuities with CMDA as the designated beneficiary. NCF does all the paperwork. They provide the documents you need to file your taxes each year. And they have assets in the billions of dollars, so they have no problem making these payments. To be honest, we've had a great relationship with NCF and hear good things from people who have worked with us in this program.
So if I want to take this home and show it to Jody, can you give me some sort of a personalized illustration of the income and tax benefits of a gift annuity?
We can. We're always happy to generate a complimentary illustration. It's called a crescendo analysis. It's customized for each individual that we work with. It shows the income tax deduction that you can have if you itemize. It shows the amount of payments you'll receive over your life expectancy and that of your spouse, if it's a joint annuity, or other important information that you can take to you and your advisor to make a decision about. It's simple. You just need to give us a call in the stewardship department, and I'll give that number here in a minute. And we're happy to provide this service.
You know, it seems like it would be wise to take that deduction when you're still getting a salary. You'll get better benefit from it then than you would another time. But what are other reasons to consider a gift annuity now?
Well, the best reason right now is the interest rates have increased. They're higher now than they have been in a number of years, higher now even than they were just a few months ago. For example, a husband and wife who are both 75 years of age, they would see a fixed interest rate for an immediate gift annuity at 5.5%. If you're single, maybe age 62, and you defer your annuity to take payments starting at age 70, you could see a fixed interest rate as high as 6.5%. And in the process, you're helping CMDA.
How could our members contact you and get more information in that complimentary analysis you talked about?
They can contact our CMDA Stewardship Department. I'm happy to help. Our expert on this really is Jeff Anderson, our Director of Gift Planning. Just call our toll-free number, 888-230-2637, or drop Jeff an email at jeff.anderson@cmda.org. We're here and happy to help with any questions you might have and can usually turn those personalized analyses around pretty quickly. So just give us a call and we'll be happy to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thanks, Dave.
Many of you probably know of Johnny Erickson Tata, the founder and CEO of Johnny and Friends International Disability Center, and have been a speaker and an advocate for people with disabilities for many years. But for those of you that don't, she had a diving accident in 1967, became a quadriplegic in a wheelchair. After 2 years of rehab, she emerged with new skills and a fresh determination to help others in similar situations. She founded Johnny and Friends in 1979 to provide Christ-centered ministry to special needs families, as well as training for churches. They deal with thousands of special needs families at family retreats each year. They've delivered over 170,000 wheelchairs and Bibles to needy people around the world. Johnny's an author, has written many books. Her latest one, A Spectacle of Glory, received the Christian Publishers Association Christian Book Award for 2017. She's the general editor of Tyndale's Beyond Suffering Bible, and the list just goes on and on. She and her husband were married in 1982, and they reside in California, and it's wonderful to have her with us today on Christian Doctors Digest. Johnny, it's delightful to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. Brings back memories of last year, I think in August, we came out and visited your ministry, and I want to thank you for taking time to be with us.
Well, absolutely, and I just want to say that I know doctors are listening, and they're some of my favorite people, these healthcare professionals, given the fact that I broke my neck in a diving accident so many years ago, quadriplegic, have been so for 51 years, so... I see a lot of doctors in my life, David, so talking with them today to me is a real treat.
It's nice to do it this way versus in the office. It's, a little different way to do it. How's your health doing? Speaking of that, I know you face challenges all the time, and you've been in my prayers, and I know the prayers of others. How are you doing?
Well, for those who are listening, I think they would agree, I'm doing amazing, yeah. Amazingly well. Having broken my neck at C4-5, cervical level, 51 years ago? The fact that I'm still sitting up, I rarely have urinary tract infections, and my lungs are working, and I'm moving forward into life, that is amazing. So I praise God for my good health. Of course, I observe every day daily disciplines that keep me healthy, drink lots of water, eat right, deep breathe to keep my lungs expanded, all kinds of good things. I must confess, though, David, I do deal with chronic pain. I don't know how I can explain that, given the fact that I'm a quadriplegic and cannot feel from the clavicle shoulder level down, but I do deal with pain in my hips, and that's a bit of a challenge every day. But, you know, Psalm 119, verse 50 says, "My comfort in suffering is this, your promises renew my life." Mm. And every day I renew my life, I renew my heart, my soul, even my body, I renew them with recounting the goodness of God through his promises.
Wow, what a wonderful promise to not only claim yourself, but to share with others. Tell me what's going on with Johnny and Friends. What's happening these days? How's the ministry going? I was very impressed when I was out there. And of course, your staff have visited here, and we've talked a lot about our different ministries and how we can work together. But what's going on with you guys right now? And what's on your front burner?
Well, we're pretty excited that we have increased the number of special retreats we hold for families affected by disability. We'll be holding 28 family retreats here in the U.S. this summer. In fact, this month is our busiest month. Retreats happening all across the United States, 5 days of hands-down slam dunk fun and fellowship and devotionals and teaching from God's word, but wheelchair square dancing and wheelchair rock climbing and all kinds of other fun stuff. And we also do these overseas in developing nations. So this is our high season right now, as is Wheels for the World outreach, where we take restored wheelchairs overseas and Christian physical therapists and seating mechanics. Believe me, those seating mechanics could be car mechanics or tractor mechanics, just so they can handle good tools and take instructions from our physical therapists. They're great as seating specialists. And we give Bibles to disabled people. We fit those wheelchairs to them and connect their families with caring churches. So we're excited about that. Plus, what's happening right now is that we're partnering with institutions like Hardin-Simmons University, Indiana Wesleyan University, University of Northwestern, among others. We are working with universities to enlighten their physical therapy and nursing students that we have opportunities for them to utilize their skills in real world on the ground settings across the globe. So we're excited about expanding our outreach into universities and getting more nursing students, getting more PTs, getting more occupational therapy students on board with us. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, I was up at Indiana Wesleyan just 2 weeks ago and spoke to nursing faculty from across the country, and they mentioned the dean of the program there, their work with you, and it sounds exciting. How many teams are you doing overseas a year? I guess that's a good question, because I'm sure there's some physical therapists or occupational therapists but listening, and where would they find information about that?
Well, they can go directly to our website at johnnyandfriends.org. That's J-O-N-I-A-N-D-F-R-I-E-N-D-S, johnnyandfriends.org, and just click on our Wheels for the World page. We've got teams out on the field in Cuba, China, Thailand, and we'll serve thousands of disabled children and adults this summer fitting those wheelchairs. And we're going to be putting up our rostrum for our 2019 trip soon. So although most of our trips this year are filled, I would encourage our friends listening, if you know somebody who's a physical therapist or occupational therapist who might want to serve with us, then sign up for our 2019 schedule. We've got some new countries we're bringing on board, Brazil, Morocco, and a couple of others. So
that's
we're growing,
great.
And I'm excited.
Yeah, and every physician listening knows physical therapist and occupational therapists and others that could get involved. And this is a great way to pass that on. Talking about that, how can CMDA members help what you're doing? I mean, it's such important work in this country and around the world. Is there a need for wheelchairs? I mean, many have patients that use them and then either get better and don't need them or pass on and don't need them. How can they get involved in that way and maybe in other ways as well?
Well, absolutely. Right now, our friends at CMDA can get involved by, if you know of a warehouse or a storage area that's got wheelchairs they're not using, or if you have a neighbor or a friend whose garage has a couple of wheelchairs in it, then again, go on our Wheels of the World page, and we've got all the instructions on how you can connect with one of our, what we call chair corps volunteers. We'll come and pick up that wheelchair, and we'll take them to any one of 16 different prisons across the United States where inmates refurbish those wheelchairs, make them look like showroom new, and those are the chairs that we take overseas. So if you have a chair to be donated, then contact our Wheels of the World team on our website. That would be wonderful. And David, I must say, we will be coordinating with CMDA to provide Johnny and Friends representation and participation in future CMDA conferences for medical professionals. I'm excited about that. And we're also exploring opportunities for Johnny and Friends interns to participate in CMDA short-term medical missions trips. So I love the collaboration that we're discussing right now.
Yeah.
And we've got a little ways to go before we nail it all down, but I'm so, so grateful, David, that we can bring the attention of people with disabilities to our healthcare professional friends. It's an exciting new day between Johnny and Friends and CMDA.
And I'm excited about it as well. And the needs are so great around the world. We have so many missionaries out there that, you know, they're going to be speaking for those of you listening, members that at the CMD meeting, we're working on that and talking about opportunities and how to do a better job with patients with disabilities. And in so many countries, they're just abandoned or ignored or warehoused. It's just a sad situation. And so we're eager to see how we can work together and do more for God's kingdom. Either one of us can do alone. Tell me about your books. I tell you, I was looking at a list here, and I thought, how do you write all these books? You've got one came out in January, a couple due in October, and I'm going, my goodness, I've written a few books, and I know that's it's like delivering a baby. There's a lot of pain before the baby comes.
Right, right. Well, I'm very good on, what can I say, dragon naturally speaking, voice activation dictating. I can type, almost 150 words a minute, so that sure does help. But I have friends who help me research. Obviously, I borrow their hands and also edit and whatnot. But one of my books that came out in January was an updated version of my publication, When Is It Right to Die? I wrote that book back in 1992, I believe it was, shortly after my state here in California entertained a proposition to legalize physician-assisted suicide in my state. Of course, that was back in 1991, and now we have seven states across the U.S. that have legalized physician-assisted suicide, including the District of Columbia. And it seems as though it's a trend right now. Many people feel as though they have the quote, right to die. And that's interesting that people think that, because that's quite in contrast to liberties. Liberties are our personal freedoms. But rights always entail the cooperation or the assistance of others. So here we are, a nation that is creating laws so that doctors who are dedicated to the Hippocratic Oath, dedicated to heal and not harm, we are asking them to assist in killing their patients. So it's a terrible pressure that we are putting on our American doctors across the country. And of course, as a person with a disability who represents many others who are vulnerable, the medically fragile, those in comas, the elderly, it's sad to see physician-assisted suicide in these seven states offered as a, quote, health care option. And to me, that is just frightening as a person with a disability. In fact, recently in Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority had tried to, quote, redefine the definition of terminal illness to include any condition with which left untreated would result in death. Well, of course, that could include somebody with Lou Gehrig's disease or muscular dystrophy, perhaps even multiple sclerosis. So this is bad news, this trend in America right now to legalize physician-assisted suicide. It's a dangerous time for the elderly and for those with severe disabilities like myself.
Yeah, and they're just defined as people with lives not worthy to be lived when personhood is based on your capacity, which is what's the basis of this. And so if my capacity is decreasing because of any reason, then it's better off just getting it over with. And the other concern I have, Johnny, is that this destroys trust, which is the foundation of the doctor-patient relationship. And that affects all of us in healthcare, whether we're participating or not. When the patient is afraid to come to the physician or anyone else, it becomes very serious. It will destroy the profession. I remember I was out in Hawaii when they were debating this years ago, and of course, he just passed it this year. But I was talking to the head of the Judiciary Committee for the legislature, and I said, if you're going to allow this in the country, let's get a group of people that wear black coats, not white coats, that do it, because it will destroy this profession. And what they're trying to do is co-opt the dignity of healthcare profession and to wrap it around this despicable act and make it acceptable to the public. And it's extremely dangerous for everyone, but especially with those with cognitive or physical disabilities, because they're going to be front of the list.
Right. And this physician-assisted suicide, these laws, when you put them within the context of a broken healthcare system, many more critical decisions now are being driven by cost containment. And when you have ethics and cost containment together, it makes for a bad mix for the elderly and those with catastrophic disabilities. Let's say like Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans, perhaps some of our listeners might remember their cases as well. So it boils down to, what kind of a society do we want? Do we want a society that safeguards the health and well-being of the elderly and those who are fragile medically, or do we want a society that extols entitlement and the full exercise of radicalized, what I like to call radicalized personal rights, which, David, if you trace it back, goes all the way to the Supreme Court decision in 1973, when our Supreme Court judges decided that there was an inherent right to privacy within the U.S. Constitution. And once that was let out of the cage, then the exercise of personal rights became so man-centered and so personal-centered that we don't care about the common good of our society. We don't care about how this will impact our national character of compassion and helping the vulnerable and the weak and the elderly. Instead, it's all about my right to choose the timing of my death. And, you know, the Bible says in Romans, it says, none of us dies to himself alone. None of us lives to himself alone. We are all connected to the main. And my decision, if I chose to end my life with 3 grams of phenobarbital in the veins, that's going to impact others.
Yeah.
Not just my family, my neighbors, the nurses who take care of me in the hospital, the janitors who mop the floor, the people in the cafeteria who prepare my food. It impacts a lot of people besides just yourself. So let's not kid ourselves. Our small decisions can have a big impact.
Well, and there's copycat suicides all the time. And what people forget, suicide's not illegal. This isn't about giving patients the right to die. It's about giving doctors the right to kill.
Right.
And because of that, we medicalize death, and we've seen the suicide rates go up across the country because it's what you're talking about. It impacts others, and there's imitation that takes place as well. So that's why we're fighting it so strongly, and I know you are as well. You know, CMDA now has 54 state directors and our American Academy of Medical Ethics focused on this issue at the state level where the battles are. And, of course, just recently, as you know, we won a case in California and actually stopped it for a month or so, and
right.
It's still in the courts. But we need to fight for this because it's very difficult to reverse the vehicle once it heads down this slope. And we just look at Canada, what's happened the last 2 or 3 years since they legalized it. I read an article today, Johnny, a person from the Canada ARP advocating that palliative care was the ability to commit suicide. And if you were in palliative care not offering that, you were making people suffer. You were torturing them. I mean, this type of reasoning, this type of stuff being put out there is so dangerous. And it gives the people the idea that there's a duty to die and you've got to get out of your way as well, which is very dangerous for the elderly, the incapacitated, and everyone else.
Right. I mean, I'm of the ilk, let's not make it easier for people to die. Let's make it easier for them to live. Let's pour more research dollars into better pain management techniques. Let's provide them community support, spiritual support. Let's surround them with people who will help ascribe positive virtue to their hardships. Let's help them get their lives in order. I'm not saying that you should prolong the process of dying. No, no way. It's just helping people find that clear distinction between treatment that will support your life as opposed to treatment that will do nothing more than prolong the process of dying. As our friends listening well know, everybody eventually will enter that irrevocable process of death, of dying. And it's just finding out when that point is and then making people as comfortable as possible, not with the motive to kill them if you administer morphine, but with the motive to support them and alleviate their pain as best you can. And that's why it's always great when these decisions are made to do them within the confidentiality of not only a physician, but a pastor, somebody who shares your life values, your family. There becomes a challenge when people are isolated and they fall prey to the lies that are often perpetrated by death with dignity groups. So I'm glad you're out there, David. God bless you for submitting an amicus during that May 16th California decision to invalidate the End of Life Option Act. And I hope that your team will be active now that the Fourth District Court of Appeals has issued a stay on that lower court ruling. So thank you for continuing to speak into the process.
Well, and I think that's one of the roles God's called to be bold, stand up, and speak the truth in love. Love the person and speak against the practice. And we want to do that. And I, you know, which one thing that really rung with me, and often when I'm preaching in churches and things like that, you know, I think there's an opportunity here for the churches. We do real well on the whole taking care of people that are seriously sick and or you know, suicidal in our churches and recognize that. But here's an opportunity to go down the street to people that aren't in our church that are seriously ill or maybe dying and to minister to them. And if anybody should be at the bedside, it should be a Christian healthcare professional if possible, but the local church reaching out to people at that point in their life as they enter the crossroads to the next world and have the opportunity not only to minister to them, but perhaps point them toward Christ before they die. So every crisis is an opportunity at the same time if you approach it in the right way. And this is a time for the church and for Christians in healthcare. And I think, too, Johnny, there's never been more important time to have a Christian healthcare professional with what's going on, not only with this issue, but so many other issues that devalue life, from abortion to you name it, and more are coming down the line. So we all need to stand up and make a difference.
Absolutely. I often encourage Christians to serve as ombudsmen in nursing homes and care facilities, advocating for those patients who often feel abandoned and isolated. I think it's wonderful if a Christian pastor would sit on a hospital ethics committee and speak into those processes. And it's important for Christian pastors to be with families, to huddle with them, to talk about these earnest end-of-life questions that so many people have regarding their elderly parent or a loved one who just suffered a catastrophic injury. They need guidance. And James tells us that wisdom is available. So I would pray that there might be many more Christians, especially pastors, Christian leaders, to be able to surround families, be able to integrate themselves into the processes in hospitals, in nursing homes, care centers, so that the salt of Jesus Christ will be sprinkled generously in places where there's such a hunger and a thirst for the truth.
Yeah. We're starting a new outreach to really try to help train pastors, physicians training pastors on these issues, Christian docs who can help them understand the science, understand the approach to how to deal with this with people, and better educate them, because unfortunately, a lot of the training they have, they don't have a background to be able to do it well. They still should be there, and they should learn, and there's resources out there, but we want to be even more proactive to equip them as this continues. What other bioethical issues are you concerned about? We've really dug into physician-assisted suicide, which is a huge one, but as you look at the disability issues, what else concerns you?
There's a lot of emphasis right now on designing your unborn child, so to speak, and that concerns me too, because it shows that there is such a prejudice against disability. Mm-hmm. I remember years ago, David, when I served on the National Council on Disability, the National Institutes of Health had submitted a report on disability prevention. And so they asked our Institute on National Council on Disability to review the report and their findings. And one of the findings suggested that abortion should be considered a, quote, disability prevention objective. And of course, all 15 of us on this council, liberals, conservatives, Democrats, independents, Republicans, all of us hands down scolded the NIH for even suggesting that abortion of unborn children with chromosomal defects, let's say, should be aborted in order to lower, to address, quote, disability prevention. And now, just, what, 20, 30 years later, abortion has become the way to eradicate disability. We've seen that recently in Iceland, where there is kind of a genocide going on against anyone with Down syndrome, any unborn child with Down syndrome. And we are starving our communities of the joy of having the integration of young people, children with Down syndrome, who bring such happiness, such gladness to our lives. And yes, at times, many times, require much of us, but that's a good thing. That much might be required of families and our communities to serve those who are weak and vulnerable. So even in the United Kingdom, some time ago, there was a family who had a cosmetic surgical procedures performed on their child with Down syndrome to rectify the large ears and to change the shape of the eyes and the nose and the mouth. And to me, that assaults that child's dignity. Then there might be some who say, well, that child has no idea of the cosmetic surgeries and how that will improve her life and how she'll be much more accepted. But just because someone might not be aware, intellectually aware, of what is being done to them to, quote, accommodate them to society, that doesn't mean their dignity can be infringed upon. Human dignity needs to be safeguarded when, and especially when, people aren't even aware of what dignity is all about. So it were concerns of the unborn child with disability, newborns, the attempts to design babies that will have no disabilities at all or no defects. This concerns me a great deal because it promotes the premise that you, quote, are, quote, better off dead than disabled. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm so glad for our physicians listening who share these life values that CMDA extols. That means so much to me because it means that our physician friends listening do have a pro-life perspective on someone who, let's say, might suffer a life-altering injury, such as a spinal cord injury at a high level, or a child who might be born with autism or with spina bifida. We can celebrate life, and life still is worth living no matter how significant the setbacks, the physical hardships. Life is worth living because it gives us a chance to know the Savior of the world, Jesus Christ. When people ask me about death with dignity, I always say, death with dignity is helping people find Christ. Mm-hmm. And even in the last days, months, hours of their life, because this life is but a breath, just so short in time span compared to an eternity which will stretch on forever. So let's do all we can to pray for, support, care about, ascribe virtue to, and lead people who are hurting, who are at the end of life spectrum, to come to know Christ as Savior.
You know, how people treat those with disabilities says more about them than it says about the person with the disabilities. And that's true with all these efforts in eugenics, which is essentially what it is. By another name, let's purify the race. Let's, you know, get rid of anything that's not whatever perfect is as we define it at this time. So, Johnny, I want to thank you for speaking out, being such a clear voice, for all your writing, your speaking. You've spoken for us and inspired us and encouraged us. You've done that again today. I just want to thank you for your faithfulness and that of your team. You've got a great one out there, and we look forward to more and more collaboration as we work together for God's glory and to win people to Christ and to provide the care they need as they struggle with their diseases or their disabilities. We can be alongside, as Jesus did, helping to take care of them and being Christ in human form.
Well, David, that reminds me so much of the story of the Good Samaritan, because just think of it. There was the wounded, injured, quote, disabled man left by the side of the road. A Levite priest passes him by. A Pharisee passes him by on the other side of the street. But finally, the Samaritan stops and has a compassionate touch. He has a genuine moral response. He wants to help. He wants to be kind to that wounded, injured, disabled person on the side of the road. So you have to ask yourself, okay, well, we understand now the character of the Levite and the priest and the Samaritan, but what's the role of the wounded man on the roadside? What is his story? And I believe, looking at that story, that wounded man by the side of the road is there to reveal the character in the other three. He was there to reveal whether or not this person is compassionate. Does this person care? Does he reflect the values that God espouses in his word? And so you're absolutely right when you say that that it reveals the nature, the character of others, because, again, we've got biblical proof in the Good Samaritan that the role of that wounded person, the disabled person, is to showcase the stuff of which others are made. So let's be caring. Let's be compassionate. Let's roll up our sleeves and practice Christianity where the rubber meets the road in the lives of those who are hurting.
Wow, what an admonition for us every day as healthcare professionals. We provide care for people, and having that kind of compassion that Johnny talks about is so important. There's lots of great Johnny resources out there, and we carry many of them. One I want to mention in particular is her book, When Is It Right to Die? It's a look at death and dying and the physician-assisted suicide issue. Max Lucado said, Johnny helps us process the hard questions of life, and she does a marvelous job in this book. It's available at cmda.org. Just give us a call at our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. Let me give you some updates of upcoming events you maybe want to participate in. October 12th through the 14th, Marriage Enrichment Weekend is going to be here in Bristol, Tennessee. It's a beautiful time of year. The leaves are changing. The weather is wonderful. You can be walking on our trails and with your spouse. Lots of things to do during that weekend to enrich your marriage. To find out more, go to cmda.org/marriage. and get all the information you need. It's not too late to register. March 28th through the 30th will be our second Remedy Medical Missions Conference at the First Baptist Church of Orlando, Florida. Registration will be up on the website very soon, and we'll be giving you more information about that. But you may want to set those dates apart, March 28th through the 30th. And if you're in the southeast part of the United States, I encourage you to come. Bring some students with you. It'll be a life-changing conference. And then May 2nd through the 5th, 2019, will be our national convention back at Ridgecrest, just outside of Asheville, North Carolina, a beautiful site in the springtime. The theme will be Transform, Celebrating God's Faithfulness. That'll be my last national meeting as the CEO, and we'll be introducing the new CEO of CMDA. We're going through that transition. It's going to be a special time to be there, remembering all of God's goodness and looking forward to what he's going to do, along with a great lineup of speakers, including John Stonestreet. Stan Key is our Bible teacher. If you've heard him, I know you'll want to come to this conference. And Nancy Piercy, who wrote a number of great apologetic books, with some of them with Chuck Colson, some of them on her own, is another speaker as well. It's going to be a wonderful time to bring your family, children's programs, spousal programs, tons of stuff to do. I hope to see you May 2nd through the 5th at our national convention. You know, I'm so glad I had an opportunity to talk with Johnny about physician-assisted suicide. This issue continues to be on the table, and it's not going away. In fact, CMDA has been ramping up its opposition to this. I realized long ago that I alone and other couple of my staff involved in public policy could not deal with this as we needed to, state by state. So I started the American Academy of Medical Ethics. This is a arm of CMDA, kind of a stealth arm that's out there speaking out against this. We have been approaching our members to become state directors or co-directors to fight this in their own locale, to mobilize members, to do media, to give testimony before the legislature, and the list goes on and on. Right now, the American Academy of Medical Ethics has directors in 47 states. We have 58 directors. Some states have more than one because there's so much to do. I want you to pray for your colleagues. I want you to get involved when they approach you to speak out, to use your influence to influence the legislature. Maybe God will call you to give testimony, and we're happy to coach you and help you do that. Physician-assisted suicide fundamentally changes the doctor-patient relationship, which is based on trust. How can you trust someone who can help you take your life? We see more and more evidence of where this goes if it's allowed to go unchecked. I just met a week ago with the head of the Christian Medical and Dental Society of Canada. They've been fighting this for a couple years now because their Supreme Court actually legalized it. It's moved very rapidly. There are thousands of patients taking their lives. 95% of the time it's done by euthanasia, a lethal injection. And that's what will happen here ultimately, because when people take a handful of pills, 20% of them have complications. They don't die. They wake up. They have bad symptoms while they are dying. And so that's where this is going to go. Already in Canada and Ontario, they're requiring doctors to refer or they will lose their medical license. CMDS Canada is involved in a suit and in the courts over that. Hospices are being forced to participate in this, whether they want to or not. There's concern that even hospitals may be shut down because they refuse to participate, Catholic hospitals in particular. This is just an enormous issue, and the time to prevent this problem is now, because once it's legalized, it's almost impossible to turn back. So I want to encourage you to pray. I want to encourage you to support CMDA. You know, as you support us, we can support you better in these and so many other issues and ministry around the country. And I want you to think about getting involved. Educate yourself on this issue. Go to our website. There's tons of resources there. And as we work together and speak out and use our influence, we have been able to stop this in so many states. I could tell you story after story where God has intervened. But we have to do this together. And I'll tell you something, the time you invest in this, you'll be thankful that you did. Well, till we get an opportunity to get together again, we're praying for you. In fact, as I came out of chapel, they were passing out cards for individual members, for our staff to pray for. We pray for you regularly and by name, and we're here to help you in any way we can with resources, counsel, whatever you need. Don't hesitate to contact us. And until we get together again, may God bless.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.